This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Takes me back to 1982 when I was a DJ in upstate New York. Honestly, that's my time.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Beyonce of education reform, Robert Pendicio.
No. We're going to make some lemonade out of
You turn lemons into lemonade.
Yeah, that's
there
just my day job.
It is. I know, you know, we were chatting earlier. We know nothing about this album. We are, like, so too old and or something
my
to be in on
this. My weapon is I've got an 18-year-old daughter.
Oh.
So I, you know, remain current. But because she has not downloaded the album yet, I've not heard a note of it.
Well, I did hear a great interview about Beyonce as a businesswoman on NPR's Marketplace. So that you know, really just tells you all you need to know about my media consumption habits.
Well, I mean, she's clearly got a model. She's, you know, she drops these albums in the middle of the night, and the next day, it's all anybody can talk about. So it's good to be Beyonce. Good to be Jay-Z, just saying.
Is it good to be Robert Pendicio?
It's very good to be Robert Pendicio. There are people in the world with real problems, and I am not one of them, sir.
Wow. There you go. Mr. Optimistic.
Hey, better be optimistic in this business.
You know, it does seem like you're more cheerful ever since the presidential campaign left New York State. Okay.
Well, yeah.
All right. It's in my home state of Maryland this week. I got some robocalls the other day. I was so excited about that.
Oh, goodness. We were having such a nice chat. You had to go bring that up.
All right. Lots to cover on education front. Clara, let's get started. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
The unexpected passing of music icon Prince has many folks reflecting on his legacy. Is it true that his influence reached the realm of education as well?
No. Of course it's true.
Yes, it does.
That was a leading question.
I was very surprised by this, weren't you?
So our good colleague Kevin wrote a really great piece about this charter school that Prince had a role in getting off the ground.
In Minnesota. And it turns out, I mean, this has been this steady drumbeat of stories, a lot of them just lovely, about Prince. Apparently he was a very charitable guy. And here's a list of some of the things that he helped fund Van Jones' Yes We Code. Mm-hmm. He gave $1 million to Harlem Children's Zone. Did you know this?
I did not know that.
Out of nowhere, something called the Eau Claire Promise Zone, which is a preschool outfit in Columbia, South Carolina, on and on. So apparently he's a very generous dude.
And the school in Minnesota, it is what we wonks would call a, quote, dropout recovery school.
Sure.
This is for kids who tend to be overage, under credit, for whom the traditional high school was not a good fit. Kids in particular who are interested in the recording industry and get to do some, shall we call it, career and technical education in the recording industry. Now, you look at the school's results, and not surprisingly, guess what? The test scores stink, and
you know, that's the nature of these schools.
But that's the nature of these schools, and it is one good point that says this. I think it's hard to figure out how to judge school quality of high schools in general, and then this particular niche of high schools is very tough. But look, great sign that somebody wanted to do something innovative in education. Of course, they ended up doing it through a charter school because that's just the easier way to do it these days.
Yeah. By the way, very quickly, my favorite Prince education story that has emerged since he passed on, here in Washington. Apparently, at the height of his fame, he was doing a show at the Verizon Center and called, I may pronounce the school incorrectly, Gallaudet,
right
down the block, and said, hey, I want to do a free show there tomorrow.
Right.
This was written up in the
For
Washington
the hearing
Post.
Impaired.
Exactly. WETA did a full show for the students with no billing. Just they showed up and there was Prince doing
That's
a show on the
cool.
campus. Isn't that cool?
That is cool. All right.
Guy.
All right. All right. Now, this has all been feel good stuff. Clara, give us something we can complain about something and criticize somebody.
Oh, no.
All right.
Wait till you hear this.
Our good friend Rick Hess recently co-authored a piece.
We get to criticize Rick.
Yes.
And former host of the Education Gadfly Show. Okay. I'm sorry. I interrupted you, Clara. Go ahead.
Recently co-authored a piece calling for education reformers to increase parental accountability when it comes to their children's education. Should reformers be meddling with parenting at any level?
Did Rick Hess fall asleep next to a pod? I can't believe this.
Well,
I can't
now
believe
he
this.
Co-wrote it with his colleague Gerard Robinson at AEI.
Okay.
They were picking up on a bill from Mississippi authored by, I believe, an African-American legislator,
yeah.
Who basically wants, as far as I understand it, teachers to grade parents.
No.
Which is a horrible idea.
Oh my goodness.
Even if we can agree that there are plenty of irresponsible parents out there, that parenting matters a whole lot, that we would all be better off if parents would get their act together. This is such a horrible idea. And Rick seems to be making some effort to distance himself from the actual bill.
He kind of is, yeah.
So maybe don't use that as your hook then.
Yeah, I questioned him about this on Twitter this morning. He very quickly immediately backed away, saying no, he thought the bill was Orwellian, but I guess he thinks the idea is good. But then later on in the piece, he also says that...
What's the idea?
I don't know.
I mean, that we should sort of bemoan the fact that some parents are idiots? I mean, okay, let's do it. Let's bemoan. Okay. Robert, some parents are idiots.
Look, let me be serious about this for a second. When I left the classroom, there were two things that I really wanted to see improve that I think would improve educational outcomes. One was curriculum, which I've done a lot of work on. The other is parenting. But good Lord, that's not the same thing as evaluating parents and putting a government agency, school in charge of evaluating parents. I do think there's a lot of work we can do in terms of raising the level of parenting, not by telling people how to raise their children. Mm-hmm. I've talked to Dan Willingham about this a lot over the years. But, you know, simple guidance, like read to your children. Think of a public service, public health campaign, like the same thing you would have for, say, drunk driving prevention or not smoking in front of your kids, et cetera, et cetera. Read to your kids, talk to them, use full sentences, ask them questions, turn off the screens, et cetera, et cetera. That makes sense to me to kind of help parents prepare their kids for schools. But Lord, let's not suggest, even suggest that we should somehow be evaluating parents.
That's right. And nudges from Hollywood, for example. Yeah. I mean, look, you know, so awful, the whole Cosby thing after his history. Right. But, you know, you look back to the Cosby Show and people would argue that this was a, you know, they were teaching parents how to be good parents. And, and that had a big influence on the culture. Yep. You know, Robert, there's one really great way to help people be better parents.
Uh-oh.
And that is, of course, help young people to wait until they're ready to be a parent.
Gotta put that in there, I'm not allowed
to talk about it because I'm a man, so I can't talk about how maybe we should, you know, teach sex ed and have long-acting reversible
contraceptives. Is there another topic, Clara? Is there, please? Bail us out, please.
Topic number three.
The New York Times recently wrote that the opt-out movement has diversified its ranks and now includes many more parents of color. Is there any evidence to support this claim?
No. Next.
That's it.
So
that's all the time we have.
Kate Taylor, the New York Times, a curious piece. Like Alexander Russo did an analysis of this and frankly took her down pretty. And I think it was fair. You know, anytime that you have a news reporter showing up on what is in effect the op-ed page, or in this case, what was it, the Week in Review, or what do they call
it? Sunday Week in Review.
You know, it had a label news analysis, right? You say...
Oh, so that's what the cool kids call it.
You know, you're like, okay, so is this sort of an opinion, kind of? So she was trying to make the case that, first of all, the premise is that people have criticized the opt-out movement for being something mostly about white parents,
about middle-class parents, opt-out so white.
And guess what? There's hard evidence to that effect.
Yeah.
That when you look at the places where the opt-out numbers are the greatest, they tend to be white middle-class. The kids who opt out, by the way, tend to be relatively low-performing middle-class kids. Interesting, right? But she writes this whole piece saying, you know, in effect that, well, but now there's some signs that, you know, people of color are getting in on this
signs.
As well. Three, maybe, as far as I can tell. No evidence, no data, a few anecdotes.
Now that you say this, last year I remember doing a bit of analysis. I got a hold of some data in the state of New Jersey of the top opt-out districts, and it turned out that I think 8 or 9 of the top 10 opt-out districts were almost exclusively affluent, almost entirely white. I should actually go back and see what that's like this year.
And why does this matter, Robert? Does this matter?
Of course it matters, because, you know, it's uncomfortable, but, you know, I say this all the time. Data is what drives ed reform. No testing, no data. No data, no charters, no choice, no ed reform movement. And who are the people who disproportionately benefit from the ed reform movement? It's low-income families of color. The greatest success of the ed reform movement has clearly been urban charter schools.
Yep.
So this is, if you take away the data, you take away the moral authority for that movement.
Now, when you unwind, you know, again, go back in history. Why are we doing standards-based reform? Why do we have testing? Why do we have accountability? Well, it's because previously we had a system where the standards, the expectations were different from district to district. And generally, affluent districts aimed high. They were trying to get their kids ready for college, AP, et cetera. Yeah. Places where there were lots of poor kids were aiming much, much lower. And even today, we still have evidence, new studies coming out, teacher bias, having lower expectations for poor and minority kids. We have situations where poor and minority parents are more interested in their kids going to college than white and middle class parents. parents are worried about low expectations in the classroom. You know, at the same time, 90% of the parents think their own kid's on track. It's because they're being told that their kid's on track. So, you know, in the absence of standards and statewide tests, what you have are wildly different expectations, largely based on race and class.
Yeah, I don't want to paint with too broad of a brush, but I don't think it's completely outrageous and unfair to say that those with the least to lose are the most likely to want to opt out.
Very well said, Robert.
Thank you.
I only wish that Prince had written a song about it.
Maybe he did.
Maybe he did. We'd have to pay for his music to find out. Okay, that is all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everybody's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Very briefly, favorite Prince song.
Oh, man. Really? I've got to pick one. 1999.
Yes.
I'm a little Red Corvette guy
Are
myself.
Are you? Well, Purple Rain's not bad either, right?
I mean, takes me back to 1982 when I was a DJ in upstate New York. Honestly, that's what I did.
Oh, I've been listening to the Tribute Prince channel ever since. I just can't help myself.
Yeah. No, it's very, very sad. What a talent.
What a talent.
Okay. So speaking of talent, we got some talent out there in education. Research.
We do. We got a new NBER working paper. It's got some unsettling news here. I don't know if you guys probably saw this one. Tom D. and colleagues examined the prevalence and implications of teachers tampering with student test scores on the New York Regents exam.
Yikes. Cheating. We're talking about cheating.
Well, it's called manipulation in the study.
Cheaters
who
cheat.
The analysts focus on Regents exams between 2003-04 and 2009-10 in New York City, since those data can be reliably linked to students. And then just a little background. In order to qualify for a local diploma, Robert, you're going to know more about this than I do. The lowest degree available in New York used to be the local diploma.
Correct.
Okay. So students entering high school before the fall of 2005 had to score at least a 55 on all five Regents exams. That was English, Math, Science, U.S. History, Government, and Global History, Geography.
I think that's right.
So that's the 55 was the magic score. Okay.
Yep. And then not a very high score, by the way.
In the fall of 2008, so this is what happened, those local diplomas were eliminated and students were required to receive at least a 65 on I-5 tests. So they bumped it up. So then up until 2012-2013, Regents exams were graded by teachers from the students' own schools. I don't know if you remember
this
that.
I did not know. I taught elementary school, not high school.
Well, we used to do something similar when I was teaching, but I digress. And the exams that were just below that proficiency cutoff, it was automatically, the policy was they were automatically rescored.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe something went wrong. Right?
Oh, and let me guess, mirabile dictu. Turns out they passed.
The analyst document clear.
We call that credit recovery.
Right. Analyst document clear spikes around the cutoffs and an otherwise smooth test score distribution. Oh, you got to look at this figure. It just goes bam, just like straight off the charts. Since the scores immediately below the cutoffs appear less frequently than expected from a well-behaved empirical distribution, their words. As a point of comparison, they then show the score distributions for standardized math and ELA exams taken by kids in grades 3-8, which was a nice smooth distribution. Okay, by the way, those states are obviously centrally scored. You know, by somebody else. All right. And analyzing the magnitude, then they say, okay, how bad is it? Okay. They estimate that teachers inflated roughly 40% of test scores
near the cutoff.
Inflating scores for students who would have failed the test by a small margin raised the probability of his or her graduating from high school by approximately 27%.
Yikes.
They also estimate that the black-white achievement gap would be about 5% larger in the absence of test score manipulation. Black and Hispanic students and those with lower baseline scores, those with worse behavioral records, benefited more from the manipulation in the aggregate because you got more numbers of those kids near the cutoff. They also find evidence of manipulation for higher cutoffs on elective exams. So this is interesting, right? Because those elective exams often provide students with other benefits, such as being able to take an advanced course or automatic admission to some public colleges or the granting of college credit. Thus, the analysts surmise that teachers are acting out of altruism, their word, mm-hmm. for students, especially since there was no evidence that they manipulated scores to receive bonuses, because they looked at this teacher bonus plan, mm-hmm. and no evidence there. And there was no evidence that manipulation was impacted by test-based accountability, because they did all these fancy things around No Child Left Behind and not.
Yeah, fair enough, but come on.
And then, so in 2011, the State Board of Regents ended the practice. Finally, after
there was an practice of teachers grading their
Well, there
own
was
exams,
an expose.
Right?
Mike probably remembers. There was some expose in Wall Street Journal that then they dug into it and found all this stuff. So anyway, not long after, guess what? They couldn't find evidence of any manipulation anymore. Mm. They say, and this, I don't know, this kind of seemed pretty harsh, but they say that manipulating scores may have been a cultural norm among New York high schools in which students were spared any sanctions involved with failing exams, including retaking the test or being ineligible for a more advanced high school diploma. It was hard-hitting stuff.
I take the point, you know, and I've been in positions where you're grading your own students or your school's own student scores. So I understand this idea that it's altruistic. Yes and no. I mean, you know, if a point or two is the difference between a kid repeating a grade or not getting credit, yeah, sure, it's human nature to say, well, couldn't this be, isn't it possible to interpret that as, so it comes from a good place, and I'm making air quotes as I say that, but let's be candid about who this helps, not the kids.
And so the motivation is to make the school look better.
Oh,
basically.
Does
it come from the principal? I mean, we've seen some of these real cheating cases where turns out it was not just the teachers; it was a whole conspiracy involving the principal, or even ahead of that.
Yeah. Right. So this isn't that, and I understand that, but it's still.
But don't you think they're going to drop out? Like,
of
if
course.
you're going to think they're going to drop out, then what does that do?
Right.
Right.
Right. That's exactly the point.
I mean, that's kind of altruistic. And then with those kids, but then on the kids with the other end, right? Maybe they've just been working so hard, you know, and they are going to not be able to take this advanced course,
right.
you know, if they don't get this extra point.
Right.
So I don't know.
That's it comes from a good place, but it's still
just. But I mean,
just...
it's really unwise policy, right? Because like you, I used to do this. I'm like, we literally at one point were grading our own students' exams, you know, and you're just like, oh.
Seems like a bad idea.
Terry, why did you miss that one?
Right.
We taught that last Wednesday. I went
worse.
Over that.
Oh, I know you know that. This was just a careless mistake. Right, right. Yeah.
Not that you and I, we never did that, Robert, but I'm just saying.
Heavens forfend, Amber.
And this is why we need standards.
Right.
This
thank you.
Is why
that is the moral
standards.
Of the story.
Because a lot of these kids, they're going to go into the real world, you know, and if they're not ready, or they're going to be told, okay, you graduated from high school, now you should go to college, because and the community college says you're eligible to come. And what happens to them?
Remedial.
They
end up
in
remedial
this all the time.
Education.
The world is
they're
prepared to judge
off.
These kids a lot more
they
harshly
not
than we
better
do.
Off.
But who wants to be the one to teach them the lesson? Daggone it, you know? You want the faceless bureaucracy that's scoring the test to deliver the message, right? Not your ninth grade teacher.
There goes Amber kicking the can down the road.
I know. Look, that's what makes someone like Checker Finn so special. He's been willing to be that person for decades now.
That's right.
All right. That is all the time we've got for today. Until next week,
I'm Robert Pendisi.
And I'm Mike Petrillo. The Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.